House Judiciary Committee, February 1st, 1977, 1:30 p.m., room 354, tape 6, side 2.
Subcommittee will come to order. The clerk will note those members present. Representative Kulongoski is excused. House Bill 2270. Mr. Allison.
Chairman, I suggested that Mr. Robert Reckon, who is also a member of the Probate Committee of the Bar and appearing on these bills, and we've divided them up between us, and I suggested it might be helpful for questioning if he could be up here.
By all means.
Thank you. My name is Stanton Allison, 2444 Southwest Broadway Drive, Portland, Oregon. I'm an attorney and representing the Probate Law and Procedure Committee of the Oregon State Bar, which has approved this bill at the last convention. House Bill 270 is a rewrite of the present 1969 probate code provision, which was intended to provide that when a successor personal representative is appointed following the resignation or the death or the removal of a prior personal representative, the question is when he would or would he have to republish notice to interested persons, which from the standpoint of this act really has to do with the notice to creditors. The intention of this act when it was drawn was that if the resignation or the death of the original personal representative occurs after the 4 months period for presenting claims after the first publication has expired, the successor personal representative does not have to refile to republish notice to interested persons. If he dies, if he dies during the 4 months period for presenting claims, then the successor personal representative has to republish the notice so that they would have the period of 4 months to present claims to the new personal representative. The theory behind this was that the creditors should have somebody that they can present their claims to for a full 4 months after the first publication. If that period is shortened because the fellow is removed or dies, then they will be given another 4 months period upon the republication by the new personal representative. It's for the protection of the creditors. I have to give you a little background why this is before the committee. I attended a panel of the Judicial Conference last summer, and they had a special day for probate judges and so on, and I found somewhat to my embarrassment, because I was the person who drafted the final draft of the 1969 probate code, and I assume this pretty complicated section here, that a great many of the judges and some of the people on the panel said it didn't make sense. They couldn't understand it. And so, following that embarrassment and a lot of questions as to what this thing actually meant when it talked about the extension of time and so on, I thought it would be very sensible to redraft it so that people could understand it. My intention, and of course it was approved by the committee and so on, my intention in redrafting it was to make it clear as to what it was intended to present, but my intention also in presenting this to our committee was that it does not change in any way the original section that we're amending as to content. I think it is clearer than it was.
Mr. Allison, I have personally not been involved in the probate of an estate in which the initially appointed personal representative died or was removed, so I haven't had occasion to deal with this section, but as I read the present language, it appears to me to say that the only additional time that's permitted for the presentation of claims to the new representative is the period between the death and the date of first republication, rather than a whole new four-month period. Now, do I understand that at present, however, the present law is being applied to give a new four-month period upon the republication of notice?
People I talked to who have worked on this thing, I think the agreement was that the republication had to be made, and the form of the publication to interested persons, whether it is the original publication or the second publication, the form of that publication is spelled out in the code, that it shall say such and such and such and such. And so I thought it was carrying out the intention that you prescribe, and this thing does copy the requirement in this thing on the republication. This is the exact language required on the original publication of notice to interested persons. It shall say that they shall appear within 4 months. Now, I think actually, and this is a mathematical situation, if a person dies within a month at the end of the three-month period, then I don't think it would comply with the present form of the statute if it would just say that these people are required to present their claims within 1 month from the first publication. I suspect that that would be contravention to the actual form of the publication, which is set out in another statute. So what I have done in redrafting this was just incorporate the present language as to what the publication of notice to interested persons must be, and I would assume if we're going to follow the present statute as to what this has to say, I think it's proper to include the requirement here that they have a four-month period.
Representative Frohnmayer.
Stan, do you recall whether this, the old language is the language in the Uniform Probate Code? Or did Oregon deviate from the Uniform Probate Code language there?
I should have checked this, but I do not think that this was garnered from the Uniform Probate Code. I think that this was something we worked out to try to work it by. I can't answer that question, I'm sorry.
It seems to me maybe Dennis can check the draft of the Uniform Probate Code on that. My only concern is that if this is uniform code language, then at least we would have the benefit of consistent reports from other jurisdictions. And if we vary from it, we might buy ourselves a problem. My other question, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Is in the new language that's added, it says republish the notice for presentation of the claims, or they may be barred. I take it that they may be barred by the personal representative after that point, but that's discretionary rather than mandatory.
This is copied from the section which sets out what the notice to interested persons must contain. This is verbatim from the present statute.
Well, but I want to be clear what happens. Suppose the four-month period has expired. Then are the claims barred automatically, or is it at the discretion of the personal representative whether to pay them from the assets of the estate?
If the estate is closed after the four-month period, then you can file your final account. If, on the other hand, it carries on for a year or so, it's my understanding that they can be accepted up to the date of the final account and so forth. In other words,
so that the personal representative could pay a late claim, but that in the discretion of the personal representative, they could cut it off after. I just wanted to be clear what that language, or they may be barred, means.
The purpose of the language, as I understand it, is to permit an estate to be closed after 4 months.
Okay.
Representative Lombard?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I can speak a little bit from the practice standpoint on this, that the statute as it now is does not mention, specifically mention, of course, the four-month period, but it does have the language in there that the successor personal representative shall cause the notice to be published as if he were the original personal representative, and my experience has been the courts have been interpreting that to require the 4 months in the republished notice. And so the present subsection 2 merely tacks that 4 months on to whatever that time period was or has been that has elapsed from the original publication of notice to the succession. And so I don't think, from a practice standpoint, from a practical standpoint, that you are adding on any more now than what is currently the practice.
I thrust in my earlier question was that, assuming that to be true for the moment, it does seem to me clearly contrary to the language of the present subsection 2, which speaks of adding the time between the death, removal, or resignation and the date of first republication to the period required for presentation by the original notice.
I see what you mean.
So you get 4 months on the original notice, and if there's, let's say, a month between the removal and the republication, you get five months.
5 months.
Well, I think
this will give you.
This
will give you four additional months. Well, let me start over. I gather though from what you're saying that that's not the way sub 2 of 113.225 is being interpreted at this point.
The problem, well, the situation I have had is that it's been a tack on, a complete add on.
Of a whole new 4 months.
4 months, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I've been somewhat educated here by the discussion. What happens here if a person dies after the three months from the first publication, and then the next new personal representative is appointed 2 months after the first one is resigned, or a month after, and it takes him two more weeks to republish. The time between the death and the first publication of the republished notice is added on to the 4 months which is required to be put in the other. So what this means is that the creditors would have that additional time from the end of the death to the first publication and 4 months after. It does add it on to the time if he republishes at all.
It adds that to whatever, well, to the original 4 months, because that's the period required for presentation by the original notice.
Because he has between the time of the death and 4 months from the second publication in which to file a claim, so the time is added on, as I understand it.
Representative Lombard.
Okay, let's take the extreme of this then. Under the proposal, let's say you have a personal representative who serves for 3.5 or more months and then dies, and you have an appointed successor personal representative. Then under this provision, the successor personal representative would have to republish, and you could almost effectively extend the creditor's period to 8 months. Is that correct?
If he didn't get the second publication started after the first 4 months period had run out, it would be approximately 8 months. He would have it as an added length of time for filing.
Is this a matter of policy in these circumstances? Is this what we should be doing?
That was the intention of the committee. In other words, you can take an extreme case if a person dies 2 weeks after the first publication has started, and there may be a contest or trouble about appointing a new executor under the will or so forth, or a personal representative. And if you have court trouble and a contest, it may be 3 or 4 months before a new personal representative is appointed. In the meantime, there is nobody that the creditor can file a claim with. He's only had 2 weeks in which to file a claim, which the committee thought was improper and unfair. And so I think my recollection is pretty good about this. The intention of it was that you should have somebody whose address is published and his name is published, so the creditors would have a full 4 months period to file with some living person. That was the gist, I believe, of the original thing. I think it's very difficult to have this phrasing understood. That's why we have redrafted.
Further questions on 2270?
I will be very glad, Mr. Chairman, to check with the Uniform Probate Code. My guess is that this is not to be found in there, but I will certainly let Representative Frommeyer know.
Thank you. 2271.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Reckon. My address is the Public Service Building in Portland, Oregon. I am appearing on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Probate Law and Procedure. House Bill 2271 adds to both the probate code and the conservatorship code an additional specific authorization for the personal representative or the conservator, as the case may be. Presently in 114.305, we have some 25 specific acts which the personal representative, acting reasonably for the benefit of interested persons, is authorized to do. The proposed amendment adds one more, authorizing him to prosecute tort claims of the decedent, including those for his personal injury or wrongful death. Jumping ahead to the conservatorship code, 126.313 again lists some 25 things. A conservator, acting reasonably in efforts to accomplish the purpose for which he was appointed, may act without court authorization or confirmation to, and then it's added at the end or next to the end, prosecute actions for tortious injury or damages sustained by the protected person. The purpose for this amendment, Mr. Chairman, is it came to the attention of the committee from members in the practice that the practice varied throughout the state, and many lawyers felt that it was necessary to specifically ask the probate court, acting either in an estate or in a conservatorship, for authority to file a personal injury case or a wrongful death case. Many times the sole asset in a decedent's estate is the wrongful death claim, and this is the purpose for the probate. And many times in a conservatorship, it's the purpose of the conservatorship. And the committee, which action was endorsed by the bar, felt that these two specific authorizations should be included in the code.
Representative Frommeyer?
Chairman, I have two questions. The first is, why is this limited to tort claims?
In both?
Yeah. I mean,
I really can't answer that. Yeah. I am fairly new to the committee, and I wasn't in on the discussions when these matters did come up. Do you remember, Stan? Was there any?
I think the answer, if you look at subsection 19, Representative Frommeyer. That is a fairly broad section, but the genesis came from former probate judge Dixon, who felt that it was unnecessary in numerous cases where the sole purpose of the probate or the administration proceeding was to bring a wrongful death, and that's the sole asset. In his opinion, subsection 19 did not apply to this kind of a proceeding.
I suppose that's arguable, but what concerns me is if we add section 20, then it might leave the implication that it's only tort claims that we're specifically authorizing him to sue over. I mean, it seems to me you could read section 19, just that if there were any, you had to sell if you had a stock loss or something like that, you could sue to maintain the viability of the estate. But let's say the person had a contract, was a partner in real estate, or had a contract action against someone. I'm not sure that it would be protection of the estate, and I'm very sure it wouldn't be a tort claim. And I'm not averse to giving this power, but I'm just wondering whether it shouldn't be more broadly worded.
Well, of course, as you say, 19 is limited to the case where the estate is protected. Prosecutor defend actions, claims, and proceedings for the protection of the estate and of the person represented in the performance of his duties. That would cover the ordinary case. Now, as far as claims are concerned, the right of the personal representative to bring actions on claims against the estate, of course, is an entirely different, a whole different section under claims. And
can either of you think of any reason why we shouldn't just delete tort?
My other concern, Mr. Chairman, is if we have tort claim in here, then we'll see all those convoluted cases going to the Supreme Court where the parties are trying to phrase their cause of action as though it sounded in tort, rather than taking what seems to me a more sensible approach, which is to say, if there's something, if you have a chosen action, you ought to be able to go ahead on it.
Answering your question, I see no reason why you couldn't eliminate that word. That's all. As I understand talking to Judge Dixon, the sole, and I believe this is the feeling of Judge McClellan, the sole purpose of this is after you bring a proceeding either for appointment of a personal representative or of a conservator, for this particular purpose, you don't have to run into court for a special order after you've performed it. And if you eliminate the word court, it would eliminate the thing just as well as it does now.
Okay. One more question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Frommeyer.
On page 6, line 5, it talks about prosecuting actions for tortious injuries or damages. Why
page?
Is the word...
I beg your pardon.
The last page.
Oh, I beg your pardon, yeah.
I mean, it creates the impression that there's a difference between an injury and damages, and that seems to me to be an undesirable ambiguity.
I'm wondering if there's any reason why we couldn't align the language of the two so that we'd say prosecute claims of the protected person, including those for his personal injury.
Unless somebody tells me there's a reason we shouldn't do that.
Something along that line that would make the language parallel and rather broader, really.
Is that appropriate to you, Mr. Reckon?
Yes.
Personal injury or wrongful death.
Yeah, I think you better be careful with keeping in wrongful death in the estate situation.
Well, no, I didn't. I was omitting death consciously because you're then into another. You're out of a conservatorship. Then.
I thought you were talking about aligning or paralleling the language.
Well,
of
but
both
I've dropped the reference to death though in that second in the conservatorship situation. There would be a departure in that respect.
Okay.
Representative Gardner?
Let me just ask you a couple questions. The first one is, have personal representatives been suing in the name of the deceased person and for the estate and prosecuting these kinds of actions throughout the state presently?
As I understand your question, yes.
Okay. What authority, under what authority are they doing that?
I suppose it's under the general authority in the probate court, and they go to the probate judge, if I understand you, and say the decedent was killed in an automobile accident. We believe that X is responsible. We want authority to file a case.
Okay. The second question I have is to counsel. And do you have any case citations under subsection 19 here? I'm just wondering if that isn't broad enough to cover this type of situation. It says payer contests any claim to settle a claim by or against the estate or a protected person by compromising. And in the same 19, under the estate, which says prosecute or defend actions, claims, or proceedings in each jurisdiction for the protection of the estate and of the person represented. Is that broad enough to encompass this situation?
I think that's an issue we were wrestling with earlier.
I have the feeling, Mr. Gardner, that this is probably a carryover from before the present probate code, where it was just a matter of you did go to the probate court, and people looking through these authorized acts have just never really known for sure and have been continuing to do that, which is, we feel, should be unnecessary.
So you're saying, in essence, that we should just restate this so there isn't any ambiguity?
Yes, I think that has definite merit. In other words, as I understand it, Mr. Chairman, 19 and 20 in the probate, subsections 19 and 20, and would be aligned together, and then 24 and 25 in the conservatorship.
It can be done either way.
Yeah.
I personally have no strong feeling about it. That's fine. I think the main question is that there's no policy problem, as you would see it, to broadening the explicit authorization beyond tort claims to include claims generally.
Not at all.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if I can hopefully add a word, the same situation on subsection 24 of the conservatorship bill, it says prosecute, defend actions, claims, or proceedings for the protection of estate assets. Well, now, whether the claim for a tortious injury or that thing, if that is an estate asset, then it would cover it. But ordinarily, when you talk about estate assets, you're talking about, I think you're talking about money or property, and that is the reason why apparently the judges have felt you had to get an order. Now, that's all I think we can add to this.
The word
time.
Protection is a little bit ambiguous also, whether that comprehends a straightforward claim to collect. A claim can be reduced to money. I don't know. Well, if there's no objection, I guess the first question on the part of the committee faces is there any objection to broadening the authorization, explicit authorization, to cover claims generally?
No objection.
And the second question would be, would there be any objection on the committee's part to having Mr. Bromka draft a modification of 19 so that it will combine these, clarify this power generally? We'll come back in a moment and take formal action on that, but we'll have Mr. Bromka review the language with you when it's ready. We have work sessions scheduled for the next 2 days, and I think we'd like to bring all these bills on which we can take action on one of those 2 days, so we'll have him get in touch with you by phone if that would be agreeable. Further questions on 2271? All right, 2272.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take both 2272 and 2273 together. They all generally relate to the matter of notice in guardianship proceedings. Guardianship for an incapacitated person, guardianship for a minor, and a conservatorship for a protected person. The original acts were all from the 1973 legislature, and I think in the time since then, where we are faced with the situation, we find there are certain cases where mandatory notice is required, which for practical purposes cannot be given. So the courts and the people involved are faced with a dilemma. Generally, in 2272 and 2273, we are suggesting amendments to take the mandatory requirement out with certain protections. Going right to 2272, we're adding the words notice is required for the ward or the person to be alleged to be incapacitated, his spouse, parents, and adult children whose whereabouts are known. And as far as the conservatorship or the spouse's whereabouts, if it's unknown, to his parents if they can be found. Guardianship of minors, we've added the qualifying words, unless the court finds that the address or identity of the parent is not known. This mobile society in which we are living, many situations arise where a child, a minor, will not know the whereabouts of one parent. The mother might approve the guardianship. The other parent, his address is not known, can't be found in order to give notice. Spouses' whereabouts can be unknown in conservatorship situations or guardianship of an adult. So generally, together, these three proposed amendments lessen the mandatory part of the notice. In 2273, we feel there's sufficient protection. This is for a guardianship of a minor. Notice must be given to any living parent of the minor unless the court finds that the address or identity of the parent is not known. This, in my opinion, would require a finding on the part of the court hearing the situation. If the court is satisfied that the address or identity of a parent is not known, that requirement for notice would be waived.
A question.
Sure.
First of all, is having one's whereabouts unknown and not being able to be found, are those intended to be different?
I don't think so.
Because to me, if one cannot be found, there's a an implication of a duty to look. And the other situation seems more, the whereabouts are not known. That, to me, it sounds different. It sounds like there's a different burden there, a lighter burden. And I
can see
if they're not meant to be different, I have some concern, aside from the merits of what test is applied, if any, I have some concern about using different language that might suggest a different version or meaning.
That's interesting, who drew these amendments. He did use "if they can be found" in one place, and the others are all identity or address is unknown, or whereabouts.
Well, there are really three different forms of reference to here. Representative Gardner?
As I read 126.007, it kind of has a situation which, if you can't find someone, then you have to give notice by publication. Is that correct?
Now, I beg your, which is this 2273?
Yeah, 2272. Take 2272. It says, "Notice shall be given as required under ORS 126.0072, and then these people, unless they can't be found or their whereabouts are unknown."
Yes, right.
Okay, doesn't 126.007, the notice provision, doesn't that contemplate a situation where you cannot find a person, and in that case, instead of registered mail, you have a publication in the newspaper?
Well, yeah, that's...
So wouldn't that, aren't you in essence then saying that you aren't going to publish in those cases where you cannot find someone, or you their whereabouts are unknown, when in essence you publish to be able to try to find where their whereabouts are, or to find them? Isn't it self-defeating?
No, it just omits the publication requirement is what it does.
Yeah, but the publication... Well, the publication requirement is basically to give notice in case someone sees that so that they can respond. That's why we publish, isn't it? When we don't know where someone is?
What it does is it really substitutes the test previously for publishing. It substitutes the condition on which you would have previously published for not giving notice at all, I think.
Right.
Is there a due process problem
even,
if we do that?
Even by publication.
Isn't there a due process problem, or at least might we make the decree subject to collateral attack if the person later shows up?
Mr. Chairman.
Dennis?
Mr. Chairman, I talked with Lee Penny, who's working on the juvenile code revision project on this issue. We discussed the case Stanley versus Illinois, and the constitutional requirement of notice to both parents in that case. In going over these two drafts, these bills, it seemed that neither of these situations necessarily fell within Stanley versus Illinois, but Mrs. Penny suggested some language that would perhaps meet your concern and your concern, Representative Frohnmeyer. And if I might, just take an example. In 2272, she suggested that on lines 9 and 10, the bill read, "The ward or person alleged to be incapacitated and his spouse, parents, and adult children, except those whose whereabouts are unable to be determined after a diligent search." So I think what she's saying is, no, under the Constitution, you probably don't have to publish in a situation like this, because the consequences of not notifying are not the same, are not as grave as they were in Stanley versus Illinois. But yes, you probably do want to do something more than the bill would indicate. You probably, although you may not want to publish, you want to show that you be able to show the court that you made a diligent search. In other words, fall somewhere in the middle.
May I come back for a moment, Bob, to the... I'm not clear from 126.007 with the flexibility it accords to the method of publication or method of notice, what the problem is. This is a familiar structure in many different kinds of contexts. What's the problem that's giving rise to this bill?
May I try to answer that, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Allison.
These suggestions originated with the present probate judge, Judge McLennan of Multnomah County, and also were indicated to us by former Judge Dixon of the
probate court, our probate judge. We're not talking about a lawsuit. We're talking about ordinarily emergency situations, and I believe that was what was in mind of our Judge McLennan. You have a situation where you have to appoint a guardian for a minor or a conservator of a minor. I think many of those situations are emergency situations. There's some asset has to be administered. The minor or the incompetent person has to be protected on some emergency situation. And of course, if you have to go through a publication of notice of this kind of thing, why, you've got a 6 weeks delay in giving is an emergency situation to appoint somebody to take care of a emergency situation. I think that was what is in the mind of these probate judges now.
Representative Gardner.
The statute says that this applies in all cases for the appointment or removal of a guardian other than the appointment of a temporary guardian or a temporary suspension of a guardian. Wouldn't that fall into the very situation that you're talking about? Wouldn't the court have the power to appoint a temporary guardian?
Yes, but apparently, as far as I know, the statute which provides for appointment of a temporary guardian is something that apparently is not widely used or used at all. And of course, these situations I speak of, where you have to administer something for the guardian, for the minor or the incompetent, I suggest that the probate judges would say, we don't want a temporary guardian, we want somebody who's going to be accountable to court. And so on. That's the only light I can throw on this. I know where it originated, that's all.
I have some problem, though, with the breadth of the proposal, given the fact that there is a statutory structure for dealing with emergencies. But anyway, Representative Frommeyer?
Yeah, I just wanted to test one other thing. You don't, the way the language is presently worded, it doesn't say to whom the whereabouts have to be known. And I wondered whether that needed to be made more specific. Because I see, if you look in the next bill, 2273, you said there's a court finding that the name and identity of the parties aren't known, and yet there's no guidance as to whose determination this is. In 2272 on line 10, simply says whereabouts are known, and that's the end of it.
Well, I think the reason for the difference in language is that there's a some apparent difference between the guardian of a minor and the conservator who's looking after property rather than the person.
But still, it does leave an undesirable ambiguity as to whose responsibility it is to find the persons.
Further questions on either 2272 or 2273? Representative Bugis?
I got a problem kind of along that line, too. You just say whereabouts are unknown, and of course, when you're getting to a point of appointing a guardian for an incapacitated person or a minor, it's a pretty significant move. You have a tremendous impact on the life of an individual, and I think a notice provision is provided. And you do in the other bill, 2073, you say the court has to make a finding here. I guess you just would aver that the whereabouts are unknown, or the attorney would. File a statement with the court. The court doesn't even have to make the finding as it does under the other. And to me, it seems an awfully slight dismissal of the rights of the individual. And since the notice is relatively automatic, and there is a provision in the code, even in the part that's reprinted here, for temporary guardianship.
I think the matter of a court finding is important, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'd at least like to see that same language in 72 before I would buy it. It ought to at least be a finding by the court.
Further discussion or questions, really?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Frohnmeyer.
I'd like to introduce to the committee under further courtesies my parents, Mr. and Mrs. Otto Frohnmeyer, sitting in the room. My dad has been practicing law for 43
yes,
years.
Yes, I know.
Doing some work on this probate and conservatorship code.
Probably chafing at the bit to get up here and tell us what the facts are. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2274 contains some amendments to the so-called Small Estates Act. This identical bill was introduced in the 75 legislature. It was discussed before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which as a committee amendments indicated the increase of the personal property valuation from $5,000 to $10,000, and also it was their recommendation that the copy of the affidavit and so forth be filed in the county where all the counties where real property is situated. Those were amended by the committee. This was passed by the Senate. It was presented to the House Judiciary Committee 2 years ago, and it was not reported out by the committee. This is the identical bill. Amendments to meet some problems that have come up in the administration of the Small Estates Act. The First Amendment to Section 1 would provide that the Small Estates Act would apply even though there might be substantial non-probate assets. In other words, you could have a piece of real property that would come within the $10,000 valuation as the only piece of property which would not meet the class of non-probate assets, in other words, and substantial non-probate estate otherwise. And the committee felt there was no reason why, where you have a single isolated piece that would need this type of administration, it should be barred from the effect of this act. The present provisions for the listing and the mailing of the present act are, I feel, a little awkward. The amendment here would provide that a copy of the will where you had the deceased dying testate would be given to the heirs as well as the devisees. This present act states that a copy of the affidavit had been delivered to each heir, mailed to the heir at the last known address. And also it was felt that having to mail a copy of the death certificate to each devisee was unnecessary. It doesn't have to be mailed to the heirs, and we saw no reason why the devisee should get a copy of the death certificate. The Act provides that a certified copy of the death certificate must be filed with the affidavit, and that shows the proof of death. Those are just simply in order to conform those two sections together and simplify them. The last amendment would add to 114.555 the words "except as provided in RS 114.545. And if I may be allowed, I would like to read the language in this matter I have left with the committee. It says, this section now provides, final change recommended by the bill is to RS 114.555. This section now provides that if a personal representative is not appointed within 4 months after the filing of the affidavit, the interest of the decedent in the property is transferred to the person shown to be entitled, and this is quotation from the act, and any other claims against the property described in the affidavit are barred. But then the previous section, 545, states that the persons to whom the transfer of property is made are answerable to creditors and to any personal representative of the estate who is appointed after the transfer has been made by affidavit. In other words, the theory of the Small Estates Act is that the people who are given this property by action of the affidavit and so forth is are liable for claims, and also if there is a subsequent probate, they are taking the property subject to the laws of descent and distribution and to a possible probate. In other words, you do have the situation where you might have an heir omitted from the affidavit. His recourse would be to bring an administration proceeding, and in that case, then the people who got property under this act would then be liable to the administrator for the property that they got. And the last amendment is just simply to make the two sections agree with each other.
Questions?
I have a few questions.
Go ahead.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to repeat a few things. First of all, on line 14 of page 2, the dollar figure is changed from 5,000 to 10,000. That's because I take it it is not uncommon to have estates with more than $5,000 of personal property, and yet that's no reason to bar them from the small claims procedure.
That is true. The I might say that my experience is that the Small Estates Act has had much wider use, I believe, than anybody contemplated when it was used. Especially my experience in some of the smaller counties of the state of Eastern Oregon, so-called jackrabbit counties, they're using the Small Estates Act in a great many cases. It's very widely used, and of course nowadays certainly to limit the real property valuation of $5,000 is just very limiting, and that was the feeling of the Senate Judiciary Committee 2 years ago.
Well, could you, would it be right to extend that and boost it up to $12,000, $15,000, $20,000? If we do anything at all with it, should we boost it up even further?
I have no, I appeared 2 years ago before the House Judiciary Committee on a bill that was, at that time, I believe it extended the personal property and so forth, some of the things to $25,000, $50,000. I expressed an opinion at that time, 2 years ago, that because there are no sanctions of any kind in this proceeding, it's just something to file with the county clerk, that there probably were some reasons why the amount should be held at some minimum. But nowadays, with valuations as they are, I certainly have no objection to the committee finding if they will want to push this up to $15,000, that isn't going to involve people in heavy litigation, I don't think, nowadays.
Then I have another question. Over on page 3, and I heard you mention this, but I was looking at something else at the time. line 7, you delete the need to distribute copies of the death certificate. Now, you, I think I heard you say that's included someplace else in the papers.
The affidavit, the Act provides that in addition to the affidavit, there must be attached to the affidavit filed with the county clerk a certified copy of the death certificate.
Okay.
So the county clerk has that as part of the affidavit. And anybody can go to it if they want to look at it. But that's just to establish death.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Question, Mr. Chairman. Whose amendment? I have a set of amendments here. Proposed amendments to 2274.
That's another witness coming up in a moment.
May I do something which is, Mr. Chairman, I ask indulgence, and this is as a member of the Bar Committee. I am not talking as a member of the Probate Committee in this case. This is unofficial. 2 years ago, the question came up on the use of this Small Estates Act, so-called, in a situation where you had what in probate would be called an ancillary proceeding. In other words, you have a substantial estate in the state of Washington, and they have a vacant lot in the state of Oregon. And I was asked by the Probate Committee at that time to give an opinion as to whether the Small Estates Act would permit that kind of thing, and I called attention to the fact that, in the first place, you can't have the Oregon Act apply to property outside the state, which is obvious, and also, second, that the affidavit which you have to file states that this is section 4 of 114.525. State that an application or petition for the appointment of a personal representative has not been granted in any jurisdiction. And I had to advise the probate committee that under that broad language, if you had an estate anywhere, that you couldn't have a small estate proceeding under this act, because it says that application or petition for appointment not been granted in any jurisdiction. At any rate, the committee at that time voted officially that the section should be amended to provide that, quote, state that an application or petition for the appointment of a personal representative not been granted in, delete any jurisdiction, and substitute Oregon. So in that case, you would have a right to have a proceeding if you had a big estate in Idaho and a vacant lot in Burns worth $5,000. You could use the act. The committee felt that was sensible. They voted to approve the amendment, but it never got into the recommendation to the annual meeting. So it's entirely unofficial, but if the committee would like to consider this as a Stanton Allison suggestion, I would be glad to present it. I think it's a sensible provision, and would make the use of this probably a little more possible.
Thank you. Along that same line, in calculating the estate value for purposes of the applicability of the Small Estates Act, do the values which are set forth in the affidavit, or let's put it this way, do the values which determine whether the estate qualifies for Small Estate Act treatment include the values of property outside Oregon?
I think the language, when it talks about the estate, it's talking about the Oregon estate and valuation. It says if the estate consists of personal property of value of $5,000 or real property having of $10,000, that is the Oregon estate, if you call it an estate, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Allison, I wonder if in the new language, the new definition of estate, if we were to add lines 10 and 11 on the bill, if we were to add in Oregon, would that have some untoward effect that I'm not foreseeing right now?
Well, I do not know of any way, I mean, even if it's a probate, Mr. Chairman, or an administration of the state in Oregon, and you talk about the value of the estate for inventory purposes or appraisal, I think in any language you're talking about the estate in Oregon, because that is the only thing that the Oregon law can apply to. So I would suggest that is unnecessary, but on the other hand, the suggested amendment should state that there hasn't been any other probate proceeding in Oregon, I think would allow the to operate even though there were substantial assets outside of the state of Oregon.
Further questions?
Chairman.
Representative Lombard.
This doesn't strictly relate to the proposed amendments that you've made here, but I know it's a question I've had in the back of my mind on the Small Estates Act. When it was first passed, I know one of my initial experiences with it was in having problems getting transfer agents for securities purposes willing to go along with the Oregon Small Estates Act. I'm just wondering if your committee is investigated this or had any experience with regards to this. Are transfer agents now agreeing to make transfers pursuant to transfers of securities pursuant to this act? I haven't had an experience with it for quite some time now.
I don't know. The only my only experience as to how this thing affects has been with the title industry, and they have relaxed somewhat their provisions, but they treat this as kind of a super affidavit of heirship in their thing. They will ensure on the basis of the affidavit in this case with the additional premium and so on, but they have their position is much more amenable than it was when this was first passed. But on the securities end of it, I can't answer that.
Were you through, Representative Walmart?
Yeah.
Further questions? Thank you both. Could you remain for a few minutes more? We'll be coming back to these for a subcommittee review in just a moment. We might have another question or two if we stay. Mr. Stroop?
Yes.
Mr. Sanders, are you gentlemen here together?
No,
oh, I'm sorry, you're here separate. All right, Mr. Stroop?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Stroop, and I work for the Administrative Services Division, the Public Welfare Division. The effect of this bill will increase the number of affidavit probates, we believe, and since the Public Welfare Division is one of the receivers of this affidavit, it will affect the amount of recovery that will go to the Public Welfare Division and will affect the revenue, unless we feel some amendments are made to the bill to spell out where the affidavit is to be forwarded and explain the consequences of not submitting an affidavit to the Public Welfare Division in the first place. It's been our experience, recent experience, we've taken a sort of a survey, that roughly one half of the affidavits that are filed in the probate department of the circuit court and of counties around the state ever reached the Public Welfare Division, or at least ever reached the Public Welfare Division in Salem, as the statute calls for. They're handed to workers out in our various branches. They're delivered to branch offices. They're sent to Portland. They're sent, who knows, all over the state. For the last one half of December and the first one half of January of this year, there were 33 affidavit probates, small estate probates, that were filed in Multnomah County. Out of that number, 13 of them were never served on the Public Welfare Division. The purpose of the proposed amendment by Public Welfare would be to give a certain address, that being Estate Administration, P.O. Box 14150, where the affidavit must be delivered. And the second part of the amendment would change page 3 at line 18 to read that if the Public Welfare Division has not received notice as prescribed by 114.525, or the division has not received distribution and payment of its claim within 4 months after the filing of the affidavit, the interest in the decedent shall not transfer to the person shown in the affidavit to be entitled thereto until notice is provided to the division and that our claim is paid to the extent of assets available. We feel that this would open the chance of when we did receive notice and we hadn't been paid, then giving the Public Welfare a chance to administer the estate by petitioning the court for the personal representative to be appointed.
Representative Gardner.
How serious a problem is this as far as welfare is concerned? You say that you didn't get notice of some of these estates. How many claims did you have of those 33 estates? And what was the total dollar amount?
Out of the 32 estates, two of them we had claims against.
Did you get notice?
Neither one of those were, in neither case were we served with an affidavit. We found, in Multnomah County, it's become such a problem that we dispatch a member of our staff to Multnomah County once a month to Xerox the index cards that the probate department sets up on each one of these affidavits. Then, if an attorney is representing the claiming successor, then we contact him and there's no problem getting the affidavit. Either a secretary has not sent it or she sent it to the wrong office. The real problem comes where people are trying to file the affidavit on behalf of themselves. They don't have legal counsel. They don't know where to send these things. And quite often they're defective. They're defective in as much as they exceed the allowable limits under the law, and then if we're not notified of it, there's mass confusion. They're not notarized. There's missed signatures. They failed to list the assets in the estate. In fact, I brought with me one here that lists that there are no assets in the estate. Yet they filed an affidavit probate, and they were on public assistance. We have experiences where affidavits are submitted to the court by absentee claiming successors. That's in the case I'm thinking about. The claiming successor lived in North Carolina. They got counsel in Oregon who filed the affidavit with us, went to the bank, drew out the money, and sent it to North Carolina before the four-month period had elapsed. Now we have a cause of action against a claiming successor somewhere in North Carolina.
Questions? Representative Bugis?
Is it good practice to put a post office box or such a specific mailing address into the code like this? Wouldn't it be better now? I can visualize, for instance, if the boxes are reassigned or something, this is no longer valid, we're going to be coming back changing it. Can't we just say to the administration, state administration, division, Salem, Oregon?
Well, I agree. I think it's rather uncommon to get
I've never seen an address put in the code. Maybe
perhaps somewhat hazardous. How long has that been the mailing address of the division, do you know?
Well, it's we've had two boxes, and that's been the mailing address for about a year and a half.
Well,
as the statute now reads, it reads Public Welfare Division, Salem, Oregon. We were just trying to make it more.
Are letters addressed in that fashion delivered?
Yes.
Your problem is that, problem, as I understand it, though, is that affidavits are being left in violation of the statute. They're not being mailed to Salem. They're being left at branch offices, or is that right?
Yes, and even our own people are unfamiliar with the affidavits.
Apparently, since I gather they're accepting them.
And they don't know where to forward them. Or they just end up in unknown files somewhere. All we know is that we're not getting all of them, because we run across them later. When we've gone back to counties and looked through their records within the four-month period, we've had scores and scores of affidavits that were never delivered to our office.
Is the post office providing anything like certified mail service now, called special handling or something, that produces some kind of document or receipt that actually shows the addressee of the letter?
I'm not sure.
It may actually be attached to something like an affidavit, shows
return
something
receipt
more
requested
than a recital of mailing. Well, Representative Lombard?
Well, it seems to me that you stopped a little short in your suggestion here for a new subparagraph 3, because as it stands right now, I have a little few problems on how we would administer it, and how any subsequent creditors, or not creditors, but subsequent heirs or devisees could in any way rely on the statute the way you suggested. Now, for instance, you say the interest of the decedent shall not transfer to the person shown by the affidavit until notice is provided. Well, are you suggesting then that perhaps you'd have to institute a form of release, and that it ought to be required that the Public Welfare Division in these cases file a release?
Yes. Merely stating that we have no claim against the estate.
Mm-hmm. How much money was involved in the two claims where you didn't get money?
I don't have a record of that, because they're so recent. It takes approximately a month, month and a half to calculate all the assistance on the decedent. Vendors are very slow in submitting their bills. Doctors are slow in submitting their bills, so I don't have that figure.
Further questions? Representative Gardner?
How much money did you lose last year after you exhausted all of your remedies that you presently have from welfare people?
It's incapable of determining that. We're not starting with a known quantity. We don't know how many of these affidavits purporting to serve us with a copy were not delivered to us that we would have had a claim. So I can't tell you how much we would have lost, except in the two estates where just in the last 4 weeks from one county alone, one of them where we had a claim was $2,061. And the other one where we had a claim was personal property valued at $3,000. So that's $5,000 in two cases.
I mean, that's how much your claim was against them? That's how much
that,
was in the estate?
That's no. That's the assets of the estate. Now, in this case, like I said, I can't tell you what the claim is, because there's too recent.
Further questions? Ramka?
Is the proper name of your estate administration group, is it the estate administration section? How do you call it?
The last administrator at the Public Welfare Division did away with a lot of those designations behind a title. It's Public Welfare Division, Estate Administration.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lombard?
you're still going to lose a number of these estates, though, aren't you? In other words, those, for instance, where you don't have documents of title that have to be sent in for transfer, where you're just simply talking about personal property. You said just a minute ago you don't know how many estates there are that have been filed where you have not received notice.
Right.
You would still lose those estates even under this proposal, wouldn't you?
We take the position that under this proposal, our claim wouldn't be barred.
Well, is it barred? Well, you consider it's barred among or after the 4 months period
after the 4 months period.
114.545.
Right. And this would mean that there wouldn't be distribution to the claiming successors, and so our claim would not be barred, and it could be subject to a probate appointment of a personal representative.
Senator Gardner?
I'm trying to balance this in my mind, because it seems to me that what you're asking us to do is to make this act more difficult, basically, for the average person to administer. You're talking about a period of time in which the assets cannot be dispersed. You're talking about this notice of the state, which I guess is required now anyway. And basically, the purpose of this, I think, is to facilitate the transfer of money in small estates, okay, without going through a long, involved process and doing it very quickly and neatly. On the other hand, by you're getting in and proposing these amendments, you're going to make that a little bit more difficult, as I see it. Balanced against that is the amount of money that the state is losing in revenue that they should be obtaining back from those people that receive public welfare assistance. You can't tell us how much you've lost because you don't have any statistics on that. Can you tell me, in those cases where you have discovered that you had a claim against the state, that maybe later at some point that you found the affidavit, do you know anything at all about how much you've lost?
No, but I'm sure we can supply statistics on that particular point. I can get real specifics on exactly dollars and cents. As far as trying to make the law more complicated by giving a more definite address of where the affidavits are to go, we're trying to simplify it because we're chasing affidavits all around the state now.
Well, I'm not worried about that.
Yeah.
That's very reasonable. My problem comes in the fact that you're going to tie up this money and these assets because they're not going to transfer until such time as the notice is provided to the division.
We're just tying up those assets and those estates where the Public Welfare Division has not received notice.
Right.
But right now there's part of the problem is that there's distribution of these assets before the end of the 4 month period. This makes that more specific, that there is not to be distribution until we've got notice and our claim has been paid at the expiration of 4 months. I can envision that it takes a minor little document from like much the same as an income tax or inheritance tax release from the state of Oregon, that the state isn't interested in a claimant or as far as taxes is concerned in the estate.
Further questions? Thank you. Sanders?
My name is Ellis Sanders. I'm representing the Department of Revenue. Certain estates, probate estates, of course, require an income tax release and an inheritance tax release before the final accounting will be approved by the probate court and the estate will be closed. Under the Small Estates Act, such as this, of course, no release is required because the estate really isn't being opened and closed as such. The Department of Revenue, though, would like to have notice of such estates, and the department would recommend that line 13, that there be added the Department of Revenue, Salem, Oregon, so that a copy of the affidavit would be filed with the Department of Revenue in addition to the Public Welfare Division.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lombard.
Would then, following upon the previous argument and request of the gentleman from Public Welfare Division, would you also then want to issue releases or receipts or releases in these cases?
No.
Before the estate could be distributed?
The probate law as such now only requires the release if there's a regular administration, and the tax laws, Chapter 314 as well as 118, also require release only if it's a probate estate. We don't look upon this as really a probate estate, so a tax release would not be issued.
What is the... an estate which is sufficiently small to be under this act isn't going to be subject to any tax administered by the department, is it?
Well, bear in mind that the probate estate may be under $10,000, but the unprobate part of the assets could be unlimited. So therefore, there could well be an unpaid income tax liability of the decedent as well as an inheritance tax.
Broken.
And your proposal is simply to enable you to get notice of the fact that the person has died.
That is right.
And if it were not for this form of notice, you wouldn't have any notice.
We could well not have a notice, right. And we have no experience because we haven't been receiving the affidavit, so I can't tell you what experience there had been.
Well,
a little feared, though, from what Mr. Stroop had said, that perhaps we'd only get a small percentage of the affidavits in the first place. I hadn't thought of that until I heard his testimony.
It's not a particularly onerous requirement. Further questions? All right. Now, let's take about a 5-minute recess, then we'll come back through, determine if we have subcommittee positions on these. Sure. Subcommittee will come to order. Let's re-review the bills in the order we considered them to determine if the subcommittee wishes to make a recommendation at this time for the full committee in work session later this week. 2270.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the subcommittee recommend to the full committee that House Bill 2270 do pass.
Discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Adopted. 2271. I think this is one in which we were discussing the possibility of having Mr. Bronka draft amendments to sub 19 of both the 14305 and 126313. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lombard.
It would be my feeling that, and I think we could do this, to move this out to the full committee with a recommended due pass with the technical changes drafted by Mr. Bronka.
You have language for the work session.
Yes, I can. I just want to ask one question. Apparently what you want is to combine, not to lose anything, you want to combine 19 and 20 so that they end up with as one subsection.
And to make clear, we're talking about all claims, yeah, not just tort claims.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
You want to hold discussion on the motion.
Well, I like the motion, but I'm because I think they'll move so long, but aren't 19 and 20 talking about two different things? That is a distinction that's useful to have preserved.
Well, you know, if for purposes of the administration of the committee's consideration of the bill, it would be a lot simpler, I think, if we kept a Section 20, deleted tort in the first sub 20, and made the appropriate changes in sub 25 to make them parallel to the extent it's appropriate. Obviously, there'd be no reference to wrongful death under the conservatorship. It's just a...
Seems to me that's preferable.
Right. Is there any objection to that approach as part of the recommendation of the subcommittee? And I think that would be easy enough to have prepared by the work session.
Then my further question then is whether you want to make any recommendation for change in 19, whether you think that if you leave 19 as it is, created 20 that's sparely, you sp- is this fair language just to cover that one situation if there isn't then some overlap? If you put them together, you're putting too much in one. If you don't put them together, isn't there some sort of an overlap?
Well, I would say I think there may be a little overlap, but I'm not sure it's particularly
Overlap's harmful. I guess the only concern I would have is that by delineating the two, are we leaving a third out? Well, just a third type of, or are we leaving any cause or any claim out? I don't think that.
Why don't we look at that question again in light of the actual language when we get it in a work session? I don't think we would be.
Is this from a uniform conservatorship code?
I will check that.
Because that might have some useful
language. I'll have an
language.
Answer for you. Right. To then restate, my understanding is that you want both of the proposed sections cleaned up and coordinated, but you do not want any change to the existing language of 19 or whatever it is on the back page. Is that correct?
Well, that's my understanding.
The back page needs to be rewritten.
But he's talking about the preceding section of
24.
That's my understanding of the committee's subcommittee's position. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, isn't the page 3, isn't 20 really for the purpose of only talking to wrongful death? Personal injury, I think, could be construed as being contained in 19, perhaps broadly, but I don't think it hurts to specifically say personal injury. But really, wrongful death is the only omission in 19, isn't it?
I think that's a question. That's part of the issue of what 19 means. I think we're safer, personally, if we let 20 reach both.
Use the language wrongful death.
And omit the reference to tort.
It seems to me that what we need here is kind of a necessary and proper clause. Apparently, my feeling is 19 is probably broad enough just as it stands that we don't really need 20, but if there's going to be any doubt, let us resolve it on the side of broadness and take care of all the possibilities. If we have some overlap, we have some overlap.
And we can make clear in our legislative history that we mean it to be as broad as possible. All right, further discussion on the motion, which would be a recommendation of DuPass with the amendments which Mr. Bronk is to prepare according to the subcommittee's instructions. Any objection to the motion? Adopted. 2272.
Mr. Chairman, I move that House Bill 2272, that the subcommittee recommend to the full committee that it be tabled.
Discussion on the motion. Representative Lombard.
My only feeling on this one and also on the next one, Mr. Chairman, is that I think it's become apparent to us that these matters need some more work. We have some semantics problems. We've got some wording problems, but I'm not so sure that they aren't in concept still valid ideas. It would be my inclination that to request that some attempt be made by committee counsel to come up with some different revisions to accomplish the same thing, or we wouldn't have these problems. I think what you pointed out, you know, in your questions with regards to the different standards between whereabouts being unknown on the one hand and if they can be found on the other hand, the concern about who determines this, and that perhaps we ought to have some specific affirmative procedure to make this determination. I'm not convinced, you know, you were alluding earlier to 126.007 with regards to publication. And just glancing at 126.007, it seems to me that your only practical alternatives when you can't find somebody or if you don't know their whereabouts, is that you are going to have to publish, and you're going to have to publish for the at least once, and very probably for the 3 weeks, at a considerable expense. And I'm just wondering if it isn't still a valid concept to offer an alternative to that. I just don't like I don't like the requirement of publication in this kind of situation, so I'm just not sure that other than costing a lot of money that it's ever is of any practical effect.
Chairman.
Representative Gardner.
To the motion, my problem is not with the language, because I think I understand, even though it is a little unclear, I think I understand what the attempt is of the bill, the intent of the bill, and what it will do. My problem basically is I don't think, and I disagree with you, I don't think that we should be in the posture of basically cutting back on the notice provisions. In my mind, I think that the point you make for most cases, and probably the great majority of cases, is pretty applicable, because when you do publish something in the paper, there isn't a great likelihood that that person is going to see it and come running back. But in the very, very few cases where someone does see it, and then maybe tells another person about it, who tells another person, and that person does appear, which very infrequently does happen, I think that it is important, and it does protect the rights, and it gives the at least the smallest attempt anyway to attempt to find that person. That's a philosophical value judgment, and for that reason, I wouldn't want the staff of the committee to try to change the language to better fit the two things I'd want to table.
Further discussion on the motion to recommend that the bill be tabled. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dugan?
Aye.
Cronemeyer?
No.
Lombard?
No.
Gardner?
Aye.
Aye. We'll obviously have more discussion on that in the full committee. Motion adopted narrowly. House Bill 2273.
I'd make the same motion I made in 2272 for the same reasons.
Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lombard.
Well, again, here I think we have a court provision in here, and I think there is some protection in here in having a court provision in here. And if we're the least bit satisfied, again, with the specific language of the identity not known or what have you, that we ought to try to attempt to change it. So I, for the same reason as on the prior one, I would prefer to see us try to rework it. That's why I would oppose the motion.
Further discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, I think it differs a little too, and I you're not talking here of incapacitation. You're talking of a minor only, and you have a finding in the court. And so I don't find the same problem reservation in my mind as I did on the previous.
Further discussion. Clerk will call the roll on the motion to recommend tabling.
Representative Buga?
No.
Cronemeyer?
No.
Lombard?
No.
Gardner?
Aye.
Myers?
Aye. Fails.
Mr. Chairman, I move to pass 2273 to the full committee. Or I move we recommend it to the full committee with a new pass.
Discussion on the motion?
Well, just a statement, Mr. Chairman. I think I would be satisfied with moving it out to the full committee in that form. Probably would want to bring up with the full committee the same questions we've had about specific language, but
the committee like to have Mr. Bromke.
I like the penny language. If this were reworked so that there were a court finding plus the diligence.
Can I repeat that language? The language was unless the court finds that the address or identity of the parent cannot be determined after a diligent search has been made.
I would amend my motion just to that corrected language, if it's
that's
the pleasure of the chairman.
That's fine. Further discussion on that motion? Clerk, call the roll.
Cronemeyer?
No.
Representative Dugan?
Aye.
Frohnmeyer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Jeremiah?
No. Adopted. And 2274.
Mr. Chairman, I've got some pinned amendments in my copy.
Why don't we take this in order, if we might, Representative Dugas, write down the bill, if that would be agreeable, and see if there are. The chair had suggested in line 11 that the reference to, or the definition of a state be made more specific in terms of a reference to in Oregon at the end. I appreciate Mr. Allison's point. It might be superfluous, but I feel, for one, a little more comfortable if that were in there.
I would agree with that.
Great. Any objection to that amendment as a part of the recommendation? I, for the moment, I'm going to treat us as proceeding within a motion to recommend with certain amendments, and we'll designate those as we go along. All right. That amendment's adopted. The amount of the estate question has been raised as to whether we want to recommend any larger amount for eligibility for administration under the Small Estates Act.
Just a practical observation, Mr. Chairman. I think we all know that you're not going to very often have real property to value $10,000 or less unless it happens to be a vacant piece of property, and even today, the vacant pieces of property, there aren't very many of them of that value. However, I'm a little reluctant to up that figure significantly, because I do think that we ought to, I think the idea here of having one gross figure and having a combination of real and personal property up there makes sense. I've always had a little trouble reconciling the fact of having a lesser value for personal property and the greater value for real property, and yet a combined value equal to the greater value.
Is there any motion on the amount? If not, we'll.
Not sure what he said. Do you want to change it?
No, I'm not favoring a higher. I just made the observation that, as a practical matter, anytime you get a residence into the situation or real property with improvements, you can't use it.
Any motion on the amounts? Motion to change, rather.
If practicing like attorneys, you're going to have to make it if you want.
Mr. Allison has proposed in line 34 of page 2 that the words any jurisdiction be deleted and that the word Oregon be substituted. Any objection to that as an amendment?
Not at all.
Be adopted. Okay, I think that brings us, unless anyone has anything on the first 11 lines of page 3, brings us to the Public Welfare Division's request. Is there a motion for?
I have a suggestion, Mr. Chairman, on that.
All right. Let me first of all ask, yes, the first request from the division is that the words Estate Administration, P.O. Box 14150, be inserted on page 3, line 12, after the word division. The committee raised a question about the P.O. Box.
I think it's a bad policy, Chairman.
Is there a motion to insert the words Estate Administration?
That's part of my motion.
All right. Any objection to that?
No.
Adopted. Representative Bugis?
Then after, on line 13, carrying right through with the hand there in heavy type, add Department of Revenue, comma, Salem, Oregon, comma, and the word and. That makes a complete line out of that, and then you go right down into the 14th line.
All right. I think it would be technically semicolon and.
Or it could be.
After Oregon. So line 13 would read Salem, Oregon, and Department of Revenue, Salem, Oregon.
And.
I guess that wording, is it clear from that wording that we're talking about a copy to each?
Well, I think since there's an and between them, Mr. Chairman, there would be.
There would be another two before the
and. And two.
Okay, yeah, that'd be even better.
To the, all right. So, the line 13 would read Salem, Oregon, and to the Department of Revenue, Salem, Oregon, semicolon, and. Any discussion? Any objection to that amendment? Adopted. Okay, further amendments relating to the Public Welfare Division's requests.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Cronemeyer?
What is this statutory cross-reference? Is that just a mistake? The second of their proposed amendments? They want us to delete 555 and insert 545.
That's not a mistake.
No. Theirs is not a mistake.
Theirs is not a mistake.
So you mean the present statute is wrong?
No.
What's the difference?
They're fiddling around.
Oh.
You have to read the words that they put.
Oh, I see. They want to then delete line 18 through 22.
They want to change.
They want to put in a new section 4.
No, it's okay. Already there. They want to change 545 and then come back in with 555. For instance, they refer to lines of the printed bill that aren't there, lines 26.
Well, what they're doing is their amendment relating to the failure, the effect of the failure to receive notice, would be substituted as an amendment to 545.
They're amending a section which is not amended by this bill.
Yeah, that's right.
Mr. Chairman, it's my feeling that if we send this to the full committee, I'm certainly not prepared to recommend to the full committee that we hold up all transfers and the legal effect of all transfers until we have some feeling for the dollar magnitude of what we're talking about.
Right.
It seems to me a fairly draconian kind of special treatment of these estates to tie it up that long and make it subject to claims that long.
Right. Is there a motion to adopt the requested amendment of 114545? Submitted by the Public Welfare Division. All right. Are there any further amendments?
Move that House Bill 2274 be recommended to the full committee by the subcommittee as a due pass.
As amended.
As amended.
Discussion? Any objection to the motion? Representative Frontline.
I don't have a request, and that is that Dennis talk to the witness and told us about that and see if we've been able to scramble up some figures between now and the time the bill's heard in full committee.
Right. We can always reopen this.
Further question
on that. Yeah.
Well, my only, just so Mr. Frontline doesn't think I forgot, I don't agree with that either. I purposely left it out in my suggestion. I think we gave them all they need with the Salem address to send the notification. Since they don't seem to get it from their branch offices. It was my complete intention to give them nothing more, no matter whether there's a few more dollars involved. That was the purpose behind my amendment.
That would be my explanation.
That's
too.
All.
Further discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Adopted. Any further business before the subcommittee? If not, we'll be adjourned to 1:30 tomorrow work session.
Subcommittee?
Yes.